You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
I'm Ben.
And we are on our countdown to the 100th episode of Fusion Patrol. And this time we start our special 97, 98, and 99 three-part episode of Fusion Patrol. And we're going to be talking about the show that started it all. Well, for me, it started it all. I don't know about Ben. We can discuss that.
Oh, it was the one that started it for me,
started it all for two. We're talking about the one, the only, the classic, the Star Trek. And for those of you who haven't heard about this show, this was a little science fiction thing that came out in the 60s, and nobody's heard of it since then, really. But
kind of faded into obscurity.
Yeah, it faded into obscurity like so many other shows, like Lost in Space, Gilligan's Island. So in keeping with the absolute insanity that is the way we do things here on Fusion Patrol, whereas a show like ours, where we can spend 110 minutes discussing a 50-minute episode of The Man from Atlantis, we are going to spend 60 minutes discussing an entire year of Star Trek. Because I'm thinking, I could be wrong, but I'm thinking that somewhere out there, somebody has probably already reviewed Star Trek episode by episode. I don't know that to be a fact, but there's probably somebody. Let's just take a brief tour of what Star Trek is. Everyone's heard the story, so we'll tell it again. Gene Roddenberry was an ex-cop, a wannabe writer. Well, that's not fair. He was an ex-cop who became a writer.
Well, he wanted to be a writer, and then he became one.
And he became one. And he did some police show or something, and then he went on and pitched the idea of Star Trek to the network executives or the studio executives. And they let him make a pilot with Jeffrey Hunter and Susan Oliver. And it was, according to legend, too cerebral, quote
too
unquote.
Cerebral,
too cerebral.
Yeah.
It required you to think. And, of course, audiences couldn't do that. And I understand how that might be a true statement. In other words, I can see how somebody might say that. Because it is a little bit of a talky episode.
Well, it was ahead of its time.
But at the same time, I think Gene Roddenberry milked that for all it was worth. Well, you know, I wrote something that was too, that the stupid idiots at the networks thought was too brainy for you folks. So I
well,
had a trick.
Now, to be fair, when he first pitched the series, he did compare it to Wagon Train to the Stars. So the executives, they already had this particular idea in mind. He had also first pitched it to CBS, and they turned it down because they said, yeah, we've already got something. It's called Lost in Space. He then turned around and pitched it to NBC, and he gave this whole Wagon Train to the Stars kind of idea. So I think NBC was looking for something that was fantastic and adventurous along the lines of what Lost in Space was, and The Cage was certainly not that.
No, I will agree that it, like I say, it is a little bit wordy, and it's not as action oriented as it perhaps could be. But I think that there is a long standing feud between Roddenberry and network executives. That's well known, and I think he played that to his own benefit in years to come. But you have to be fair to them. Even though that wasn't what they expected, it's unheard of for them to give you another shot. So if they thought it was too cerebral, they still...
They thought there was something there.
They thought there had to be something there that was worthy of their time and effort. Or they just simply would have said no and had somebody else put something together of that nature. So I think they've gotten a slightly shrift. And you know, we make fun of the networks, too. I mean, they did do lots of incredibly stupid things over the year. But you have to say they at least went to bat twice for Roddenberry on that
one. Well, Roddenberry and Gene has been, he has given the network executives some sort of credit in saying, but they did do something that was very unexpected. And they gave us a second chance.
Yeah. So, first pilot, you know, we'll just ignore that one because that's really was largely unaired for many a many a year in its correct form. The story revolves around a guy named Kirk, James Kirk, Captain Starship Enterprise, a young stand-up, I mean, really, really cut in the mold of the hero. Yeah.
Blood Scout.
But very, very smart. I think that's not played up as well as it should be in the series, is that Kirk is obviously brilliant.
Just terribly smart. And there are moments in the series where he really does get to show how incredibly clever he truly is.
Yeah. You know, they play Mr. Spock up as the incredibly brilliant one, but really Kirk is, you know, you wouldn't be command of that kind of starship at that age if you weren't absolutely had all your ducks in a row and basically brilliant. And it shows in that he is so successful and that he can always pull it out of the fire. And not once is he ever portrayed as stupid. Don't get me wrong there. But
no, but you're right. A lot of the times the series would more spotlight Spock as being the one who came up with the incredibly logical, brilliant analysis idea that Kirk would then use in order to get themselves out of whatever sticky situation they might have found themselves in.
But the fact is, Spock was his tool. And so, I mean, I don't mean that in an unfair word.
Say, but you're correct.
Yeah, I mean, he is a resource that Kirk, much as we have our iPads, he had Mr. Spock.
That's the position of science officer. You could make that argument with anybody.
Under his command.
Yeah, anybody under his command. Everybody there is a tool, a resource. I mean, that was the entire point of the ship.
Right, right. Mr. Spock, the Vulcan, half-Vulcan, this is a character that as a kid I really loved. And it's not saying I don't now. I mean, you know, as a character.
No, but you're right. As a kid, I mean, he was the character that everybody at least wanted to emulate.
I like Mr. Scott better, but
yeah, I did too. He was
like
my favorite.
Mr. Scott better, but Spock and this is a chance we finally get to talk about it. I have always felt that Spock has done a huge disservice to kids our age and younger who grew up watching this show, because Mr. Spock is logical. We're told that over and over and over again. He's logical. He's ruled by logic. He's, you know, logic is his game. But the fact is, it's not true. He's unemotional.
Yes.
And he does not adhere to the rules of formalized logic.
Even though he
claims
tries to. He tries to convince himself that he does. But he doesn't. There are so many instances in the series where that's shown.
But if you're a kid growing up and you think about it, this is held up as the exemplary example. This is what logic is. But when you go to university and they put you in a logic class, you find out that's got nothing at all to do with what they were showing you on Star Trek. Star Trek is detachment.
Yeah.
Unemotional detachment. Dispassionate. Mm-hmm. Is the correct word for it, more so than it is pure logic anyway. So that's my gripe about Mr. Spock in old age. Looking back on it, it's like, you know, I probably would have gotten along a lot better if I had figured out what logic was for real at an earlier age than what they told me to say anyway. And there's some other people we can talk about, McCoy, and yeah, he's a doctor. He's kind of folksy kind of guy. And then there was Scotty. And then there's the rest of the Seven Dwarves. Scotty was the engineer. He was the badly. Scotty, Mr. played by James Doohan, had the Scottish accent because, well, in the 23rd century, I guess they still have accents like that. And it's not a real one. And
no.
Unfortunately, it's the one I now have for Scottish accent.
And it is so not authentic.
Exactly. Anyway, to the show. Anyway, I mentioned that it was the show that started it for me, and I will say that my earliest memories of television are Spock's ears. I can remember Kirk and Spock when I was, I don't know how old, but relatively young, and Star Trek went into syndication, and there was like an ad on TV. So, you know, Star Trek was in 67-ish time frame when I was, you know, three. which is not a good time for memorizing TV, frankly. When it went into syndication.
Well, that's when most people began to see it.
Right. Well, I had seen it before. There's no doubt about that. But when it went into syndication, the first time they put up an ad, you know how the local TV stations used to put up like a card that would just be a picture and Star Trek starting Thursdays on Channel 9 or whatever like mm-hmm. that? The first time that picture came up and it had a picture of Kirk and Spock on the bridge, it was like, I know that show. I mean, I could remember that from the 3, 4, 5-year-old time range.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I could remember. It was, you know, like somebody walking on your grave. I knew it, and I was like, oh, this is... And then, you know, I watched it every day for the rest of my life. Or at least until they stopped playing Star Trek every day.
I remember seeing it during the network run.
Well, you're old, though.
No. True. I mean, I was – I'm trying to think. I must have been – yeah, I was 5. I remember I was 5 years old.
You got a couple years on me.
Yeah, I do. And I remember seeing it on NBC. And I remember the flyby of the ship and thinking
– what was that?
That does not – well, I remember – as a kid, I had the iconic image of the flying saucer in science fiction films, even at that age. And when I saw the Enterprise do this flyby, I kept thinking, well, that – it sort of looks like a flying saucer, but it doesn't, because there's all this extra stuff attached to the saucer. And I, you know, these are the things that I was just totally keying in on visuals. I remember I remember Spock with the funny ears, and I remember the bridge and the transporter, and those are the only images that I have left of that time. And it wasn't until I would say probably when I was 12 is when the show more like 11. That's when the show began to really start taking steam, picking up steam in syndication. And I started catching it then in what they call stripped format, where they took a 52-minute episode and turned it into 43 or something hacked them to bits.
Much later, but yeah, they were showing them probably in Tucson anyway, in syndication, probably by 72 or 3 at the latest. Watching that show over and over again, and I think Star Trek does have a certain amount of moral high ground. It's not perhaps as much as people in retrospect have made it out to be, but Star Trek is about people being good. And
it was a little preachy.
It's a bit preachy, that's right. And it is trying to be a morality play. There's no doubt about that. And I took a lot of my ethics from that, I have to say. It shaped me what I thought was right and wrong and what you should and should not do. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, a lot of good science fiction, I think some of the best science fiction ever written, always asks some kind of question. I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be a morality play, but it gets you thinking about some you know, so political, social, human issue. I mean, those are the most thought-provoking science fiction stories, and Star Trek was filled with those.
I wonder if that's I agree that is there's a great amount of the literature is shaped that way. And
not all, but a good deal.
I wonder if that is a self-fulfilling prophecy, that you go into science fiction thinking science fiction has to be about something, and so that produces a greater amount of people trying to produce science fiction that looks at some aspect of it.
And I think that's I wouldn't necessarily agree with that. I mean, science fiction, it has to have a story. Otherwise, it's nothing but window dressing. It has to have some kind of a story. And, of course, you've got human writers. So what do? You start projecting your own human values into a story in order to make it interesting, at least for yourself as an author. And you're putting science fiction dressing on it. So, yeah, I think by nature, they're going to take some kind of a morality stance.
Okay, but I'm going to take a step back and say there are a lot of science fiction TV shows, particularly modern science fiction TV shows, and I'm picking on them, and this is why I don't watch a lot of modern science fiction TV shows, that they have taken the notion of wagon train to the stars to heart, even though we don't have Westerns anymore. These are just ordinary people with ordinary problems. Alcoholism, sleeping with their best friend's wife, rape, beating people up, just having insecurity and all that stuff. And they've taken ordinary people and you put them on a spaceship and ta-da! It's brilliant science fiction drama because...
No, it's not.
Well,
not necessarily.
I'm going to say you're correct. No, that's not. But what I am saying is that a great amount of it nowadays, that's what they do.
Oh, I agree.
And
that's exactly what Star Trek does. And that's why so many of them are crap.
And that is not what Star Trek does. Star Trek is taking basically sort of unrealistic characters, which is fine with me. And
you could say maybe
trying to explore issues from an angle instead of trying to put ordinary people in, you know, just a slightly different circumstance.
Anyway. You know, and well, again, we have to consider the time. This is the late 1960s. I mean, in order to make television interesting, you didn't deal with real type people. You had to deal with stereotypes. You had to, you know, say, for example, you know, okay, I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit, but, you know, we know that in the third season, there's an episode that deals with – actually, okay, in the first season, there's an episode that touches on the issue of racial bigotry. And the way it's done, it's heavily bigoted.
Were you talking about Balance of Terror?
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
There's
people are still
there's,
bigots
it's,
in the future.
It's – yeah. It, but it's done in an almost sort of cliche sort of way. I mean, the guy almost could have been Archie Bunker.
So now here's an interesting thing. So you're right. That episode is about bigotry. And it does – and the Balance of Terror does lay it on rather thick at the end. You know, because the guy is bigoted against Spock because Vulcans look like Romulans and his family were killed by Romulans. And so throughout the whole episode, he's pretty freaking nasty to the first officer of his ship.
Pretty badly.
And, you know, that usually doesn't cut it on a military ship. And then at the end, Spock pulls him out of a room where they both could have died. And he's like, oh, if it wasn't for Mr. Spock, sir, I'd have just been dead. And it's very... very heavy-handed, but...
It's very heavy-handed,
but... that lesson is far better for what it was trying to accomplish than what the racial issue in Star Trek that is remembered. Do you remember what that is, the big one?
Would that be Let That Be Your Last Battlefield?
No, that one's the comical one. But the one thing about race that's remembered about Star Trek to this day is that Kirk kissed Uhura.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the first interracial
big
kiss.
Big deal. You know,
yeah,
kinda
yeah,
yawn.
We go yawn on that one.
Even back then, I didn't realize it was. Of course, I didn't live in the South, so the first time I saw that, I'm like, you know, okay, fine. He kisses everything else. He can get his lips on.
Well, you were also
so.
Very, very young, so you didn't have any of those social racial stereotypes programmed into your brain anyway.
So, what if he had kissed Spock?
I would think that probably a young kid would take a look at that and say, and.
See,
an adult, however, would have gone completely ape on that.
So, I don't know. You know, that's the thing. But I take from Star Trek a lot of what I consider to be what's normal, what's right, what to aspire to. And one of the criticisms that's frequently laid on Star Trek is that it's a ridiculously unrealistic world. And this is the Babylon 5 criticism that... You know, the Enterprise would have been built by the lowest responsible bidder. There probably would have been some union problems. You'd have some drug trafficking going on the ship somewhere. And you'd, you know, these people would be flawed, normal human beings, not the uber captain that Kirk is.
Well, that sounds like the Dorothy Fontana argument.
And I don't go to my fantasy television to watch crappy people be crappy to one another. And that's just my personal preference. But, you know, it's a story, it's a fiction, it doesn't have to conform to reality.
I agree. I agree completely. I mean, yes, you're absolutely spot on.
And so for everyone who says, you know, that's just ridiculous, in the future we'd still have greedy people and we can make the argument. You've got a transporter. You can make anything in existence. You have to explore the possibility. What would an economy look like in a world where energy was cheap and plentiful and you could replicate all basic and even complicated needs. And I don't think that the people who go, oh, you know, Star Trek is not going to be like that. I agree, it probably won't be like that. It will probably be something we can't envision. But that,
right,
to me, is true science fiction.
I agree. And my argument, but the also thing that I would say to people who make those points, make those arguments, I would say, then you're missing the entire point of the series. You're missing the point of these stories, that they're the lessons and the morals that they're trying to teach you. If you're going to start harping on these irrelevant points, then you're not seeing the forest for the trees. You're completely missing out on the big picture by doing that. It's a ludicrous argument to start saying people would be, you know, they wouldn't be so noble, they wouldn't be so good, they'd be more base, you know, there'd be a lot more drug abuse, there'd be a lot more this, there'd be a lot more poverty. I mean, and he's like, okay, so you want a dystopic future then? Is that what you're saying? You want to see dystopia instead of something that looks like a possible utopia of humanity?
Yeah, and I mean, that's
the whole point that Gene was trying to make. I mean, he was, you know, We can say whatever we want to about Gene's abilities as a writer, please don't even get me started on that. That's next episode. But Gene believed that humans could be better. I'm not going to fault him for that. Now, maybe that's naive. Maybe that's idealistic. But you know what?
It's the definition of naive and idealistic. Yeah.
That's at least if I'm going to be delusional, that's a healthy delusion to live under.
It's worth aspiring to.
Yes, it's exactly. And that's what he was trying to show in the series. Now, granted,
must the mirror reflect what we are?
Good point.
Or can the mirror reflect what we dream
to be? What we hope
to be. And to me, it's dream.
Yes. And that's what he was trying to show throughout the entire series. I mean, they went into greater detail about it by the time we get into Next Generation, but there are some episodes. There's one episode particular in the third season where that is briefly addressed, very very briefly, where Uhura gives this little, "Oh, we don't believe in those, you know, those racial things. You know, words like that don't hurt me anymore."
Oh, the Savage Curtain. Yes.
Savage Curtain. Very good. So it shows that this.
Hey, I know my track. It's
so
nothing else.
I didn't doubt it. I never doubt. I figured you would guess it. But the point is that Gene had this vision. He had this hope of what humanity could turn into. He held on to that hope till the day he went to the grave. You know, and like I said, was he being an idealistic fool? Maybe, but you know what? That's a good foolish dream to have. So for him to tell these stories with that kind of idea, I think is an awesome framework.
I would certainly rather my kids grow up watching Star Trek than I would rather my kids growing up, say, and I'm just picking on Battlestar Galactica here.
But you know, I was going to say that.
Battlestar Galactica is a good example of
the reboot.
The reboot is just frankly
a dreadful
group
show
of people that I would not want my children.
I was going to mention that exact same, the very same series. That is the polar opposite to what Star Trek is.
And it's not saying you can't tell a good story in that situation. Like I said, there are. I'll go out on a limb here. Blake 7 is a dystopian future.
Oh, very.
And you can still tell a good story about heroics and triumph and fighting for right and still have your ambiguity about what is right and what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's for us when we get back on Blake 7. A couple of things I do want to mention about Star Trek before we actually kind of talking about some of the episodes. There's another thing that I really appreciate about Star Trek. It was made at the right time that it's beautiful, particularly in the early series. The cinematography on it
is absolutely
lovely. You do not see eye lights anymore. You do not see shadows on sets where people cross in and out. It was lit by a pro who was trying to create an atmosphere and on film. And if you turn around and you look at something like Star Trek The Next Generation, which was filmed on videotape or videoed on videotape.
At least the first season
flat.
Was. Yeah, the first season was.
And all, basically, well, that's not true. They've begun to make television interesting again, but there was a long period of time in the 70s and 80s and 90s where everything was flat.
Oh, very.
And disinteresting. And Star Trek is crafted.
There is one episode that I think is, in some ways, is just beautifully shot, and that is from the first season, mm-hmm. and it's The Enemy Within.
Mm-hmm. With Kirk's doing his cat imitation.
Yes. Oh, God. But there are some really great camera close-ups and really weird lighting and angles that highlight the tension and the mania of this evil doppelganger that has been created by the transporter. Really great mood setters. And that's something that got lost.
It got lost by the third series of Star Trek, to
I
be
think
fair.
It got – was it around even in the second?
And not so much. The first was really
– it was filled with it in the first season.
Yeah. In particular, the first season was very
lots
moody.
Of use of shadows. Very moody, and I liked that. I mean, there's a great scene. We mentioned Balance of Terror a little bit ago. There's a really beautiful dialogue between Kirk and McCoy, and it's all because you know Kirk is he's brooding about the pressures of command, whatever, in his quarters, and they really went for some very dim lighting with some like just single spots.
That's the "Don't destroy the one named Kirk" speech.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's and just single spots on Kirk and McCoy. And
cool,
it just,
yeah.
It's fantastic because it just, your attention is now solely on these two. I mean, you don't even pay attention to the fact this is now in Kirk's quarters. You forget that it's in Kirk's quarters. You are just engaged in this dialogue. It's almost like something you would have seen in really good theater, really in a really good theatrical play, where you want to highlight a dialogue between two people. It is so gorgeously shot. And again, as you point out, eye lines. Oh, fantastic. Fantastic lighting of just eyes alone. And you can tell that because there's some kind of a really weird filter, and you can see where the light and the shadows are mm-hmm. On the face. But they want you to look at the eyes mm-hmm. in that particular scene. And that episode, again, there's some really great stuff there. That's something which got lost, and it's a bit of a shame because it really helped to create a mood and helped to further tell the story.
Yeah, it's again, it's an influential a component on what I grew up watching and understanding to be the way you want to do TV. You know, let's talk a few. And here's a big spoiler for everyone. Everything that we're going to talk to you about in Star Trek series 1, 2, and 3 over the next few episodes never happened. Was totally wiped out of existence. So it's not really a spoiler. So
yeah, not anymore.
Yeah,
it's an alternate universe now.
Wiped out of the timeline. The Doctor couldn't have done a better job. Let's see, which ones, what is memorable to you out of the first few there? The pilot is Where No Man Has Gone Before. It's not the first episode because they wanted one with a monster. Now, this is one of those stories about how the networks had a different idea, and they wanted people to see a monster on the first episode because it's a space show.
Yeah.
And so they bumped the man trap up to the front. I enjoyed that episode. I don't have anything to say about it.
It's not a bad episode. I mean, it's certainly not one of my favorites, but it's not a bad episode. I mean, it's has this little scary aspect to it, but in proper Star Trek fashion, they try to give some sort of a morality play compared to the hunting of the buffalo.
Charlie X is a story I never liked. I didn't like it as a kid. I didn't like it now. I don't like the actor who played Charlie.
I don't mind the actor. I think he's pretty good.
It's
not one of my favorites, though.
But watching the show now, with a different understanding, i.e. being an old man and understanding adolescence a little bit better than I did pre-adolescence when I first saw the story. And this is an interesting thing about Star Trek, is that I saw it pre-adolescence, and so, you know, the stuff about sex and stuff I didn't get the first time through. And so as I got older, I didn't get it anyway, because I had already embedded in my mind what the story was about. And Charlie X is about sex, basically. A lot of it is about his needs as a teenager to that crush he has on Janice.
Yeah.
And I guess in a way that's kind of forward thinking on the part of Star Trek. I'm not used to that kind of.
Yeah, in some ways it almost felt like you're watching a video from a sex ed class in school.
Kind of. Yeah. It really, you know, when he's talking about I need you and stuff at the end, when he goes away to a commercial break and stuff, I'm like, you know, okay, well, he's just, I don't know what I was thinking when I was a kid, but, you know, afterwards you realize he's like really trying to, you know, slip her one there if he could, which of course he could with his powers. So that never, I guess that's, he didn't think of that. But anyway, I bring that up just because there were some things in Star Trek that I didn't get as a kid.
Well, I think, you know, when I watched it as a kid, the only thing that I walked away with was one horrifying scene where Charlie is basically having a tantrum as he's walking through the ship. And there's one bit where he walks past this one female crewman and he totally gets rid of her face. And she's making this horrible noises as she's going around a corner, and she has no mouth, no eyes, no nose. This woman is now suffocating.
Mm-hmm.
But she's vocalizing.
Well, that part creeped me out. I agree. That was kind of creepy. And then the other thing that bothers me is that there are turkeys there's a galley on the Enterprise.
Oh, yeah.
Which is totally written away by the rest of continuity, the rest of the series. But in that episode, they have a...
Well, they bring it back for another movie.
Well, they bring... and that's why you shouldn't allow a jackass like Nick Meyer to do a film. But, actually, I take that back. He was all right. I've read his autobiography. I like him a lot better after reading his autobiography than I did seeing his movies. But that's another story. Let's see. Big ones. We talked about The Enemy Within a little bit. Mm-hmm. That's where Kirk is split in the transporter. Which is, you know, an interesting idea where we get to examine good and evil in
but
a human,
duality.
Again, here is an idea that you cannot do outside the confines of science fiction.
No.
You know, you can
maybe do it in a more metaphorical sort of sense.
Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
some people consider it science fiction, but yeah.
Well, yeah, it is Jekyll and Hyde. I mean, it could be told in a non-science fiction sort of way, but it would be more symbolic, less literal than what we got in this particular episode.
Yeah, this is very and Kirk gets to, or William Shatner, I mean, I call him Kirk. I mean, he'll be forever Kirk. You know, gets to do his wild man. And here's another one I didn't get. He's trying to rape Janice Rand. Obviously, Janice is like penis magnet
she
in this series
be.
Because, you know, that's the first. There's another scene in one of the episodes where Kirk is bitching to McCoy and he says, you know, Gilman, stop hovering over me. And then she leaves the room and Kirk says to McCoy, if I ever get the headquarters genius to assign me a female yeoman. And McCoy, just right on the beat, says, what, don't trust yourself, Jim?
Mm-hmm.
And the look he gives McCoy, it's like,
I should slap you.
it really is a product of another time because it just, it's like sexual harassment is just, you know, you put a girl in there, you got to expect her to be sexually harassed. You're not going to see that on Barnaby Jones.
Oh, heavens no.
You know, you might, the bad guy might do it, but you are never, not the hero. You're not going to be putting the idea in the head that the hero actually thinks about raping a woman. And that's what we get from The Enemy Within. Is that
Kirk's intrinsic
part of Kirk, a key element of his personality. It's suppressed and it's held down, but it's there.
Well, Kirk the womanizer. I mean, we see that it becomes heavily exploited throughout the series and touched upon again, even in one of the Star Trek films, about how he's something of a Lothario.
And yet he isn't in the first series.
No, not so much in the first series. He's very professional. And I would say
– And gentlemanly.
Very gentlemanly. I would say that in this episode where he's bitching about, you know, getting, you know, talking to the quartermaster about signing me a female yeoman, I kind of thought that, that was more of a sexist kind of comment about how women are they hover, they're clingy, they're all these things that,
that could be what he meant, yes, but it's not what McCoy meant.
Oh no. No, in fact, it's very possible that maybe someone heard what, you know, a writer heard what McCoy said and said, we might have something here. Let's turn Kirk into this. So we have these, like, it's, you know, I'm just offering a theory here. You know, there's two schools of thought. I mean, you've got, you know, the writers had this idea that, you know, I'm going to make Kirk really stand up. I mean, you know, I called him a Boy Scout, but he's going to be like uber professional, almost dispassionate, and he is during the first season. Much of the first season, he's largely unemotional.
I you know, in the Conscience of the King, where he's kind of wooing the girl whose name I can't.
That's Caridian's daughter.
Caridian's daughter, and I can't think of her name. It's save my life. The actress who is stunningly beautiful young lady who used to be in Ironsides. She is Kirk. This is another thing about Star Trek, is that it feels like it's from a different era. And I can't tell if that's because they're coming out of the past and they haven't made it into the future. And I'm talking about the time when it was made, not the time that it's supposed to be. Because Kirk treats her, you know, we're talking about take my arm and formal walk around kind of thing. This is not, oh, let's hold hands or anything. I mean, this is very...
There's something very old school about
old school about it.
Yeah.
You'd almost picture him being in a military cadet from West Point in the 1800s kind of.
I agree.
Attitude.
And I think you nailed it. I think it's because of the time that this series was made.
Because there's another funny thing in one of the episodes.
By the way, the character's name is Lenore.
Lenore, yes.
Lenore Caridian, and played by Barbara Anderson.
Barbara, I knew it was Barbara. I kept thinking Barbara Eden, and I knew that wasn't right.
No.
Anderson, Barbara Anderson.
Although she does have a connection to Star Trek.
She's
that's come later on.
Stunningly lovely eyes, that woman.
Oh, she does,
Barbara
yes.
Anderson.
And they really play on that big time in the episode.
Well, they've got those eye lights that they can use on her. She looks.
Oh, it would be on highlights.
Crazy. I mean, when
spotlights.
she's given her thing at
the crazy
end,
speech at the end, yeah.
And they've got the lights on and those big gorgeous eyes and the way they've got her lit. She looks
just
absolutely batshit nuts.
Those lights. She looks nuts.
Yeah. There's another one in. I think it's probably the Squire of Gothos, where. Kirk is, I think this is where it is, Kirk's and McCoy are trying to explain how to put Trelane down in their log. And, you know, God of War, little boy. And he says to Spock, he says, come on, Spock, surely this is the sort of thing you did as a dipping little girl's pigtails
in
ink wells. And I'm thinking, you know, when I was in first grade, the desks we had an indentation for an inkwell.
Yep, mine did too.
But by the time I was in second grade, they had replaced them with something from the 60s or 70s, and that was gone. And I'm thinking, 23rd century, how would the writers really miss that the boat on that one? When they wrote that line of dialogue, they
It struck me that they were delivering that line. And again, you know, I think –
it's for the audience instead of for the reality.
It's for the audience. It's for the adult audience that is watching this because they can relate to the idea. They grew up in a time where you did have inkwells on your desk, and the girls were wearing ponytails. You know, they did put their hairs in ponytails, and the idea of grabbing the girl's ponytail who sits right in front of you and dipping into the inkwell. You know, the little mischievous boy who's doing that. I mean, that's not foreign to the adults who are watching the show. And I'm just barely old enough to – I mean, not that we had that, but I've read a lot of those stories. I've heard a lot of those stories as I was growing up, so I understood the reference.
Oh, I understood the reference. It's just it's – you know, looking back on it, this is one of the really bad anachronisms – one of the few really bad anachronisms in the story. Perhaps the computer technology is a little bit unrealistic, but apart from that, you know, you look at that one scene and you go, I'm not buying that Captain Kirk has ever seen an inkwell outside of the Abraham Lincoln Museum.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure he went to every summer as a child.
Yeah.
Let's see, what other episodes did we have in here that were worthy of mention?
Oh, well, one that I think you have some sort of personal appreciation for, Arena.
Arena, based on, what is it, Frederick Brown's story of, and I've read the short story.
I did too.
It's about, two combatant fleets being one representative taken from it and placed in an arena with one of the opponent and having a fight. I love that. I love that story. I have to say, it's not just because it's set at Vasquez Rock, which I think is just an enormously cool geologic structure. I like the Gorn. Obviously, it could be better.
But it was the time.
For the time, it was great. And now with the digital effects, it blinks, which I love.
Oh, yes.
I love the blink. When it
that
blinked the first time, I'm like, it blinked. It's an eye.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk has to... This creature, which is vastly stronger than him, also a starship captain, and, has basically appears to have every advantage except for speed.
Right.
And, Kirk uses his chemistry knowledge to create gunpowder.
Creates a little mini cannon and shoots a pile of diamonds into the chest.
Into the chest of this creature. And here we go. This is the other anachronism. I am curious as to whether or not in basic chemistry class in the 23rd century, they would touch on gunpowder.
That's a good point because that's so not 23rd century.
Yeah. But nonetheless, again...
But Kirk, we know that Kirk is also
a history buff.
Exactly. He's a fan of history, and if we want to refer to the later movies, we know that he has he collects handguns.
Right. So it's possible, or of course it could be that they put it in the later movies to retcon the fact that how would Kirk know about gunpowder? I mean, you have to put the chicken first, and the first episode is Arena. There was no real mention of Kirk being a history buff up to this point in the series. So,
no.
But nonetheless, I mean.
But it doesn't strike me as. I mean, we know that we know later on that Kirk's favorite president was Abraham Lincoln.
But here we go. See.
So there's that sense that he likes that history.
Right. Well, and that was later on. But yeah. But again, in this episode, Kirk wins by
using his brain,
knowing things.
Mm-hmm.
Being knowledgeable, being educated. And again, this just appealed to me as a kid. This is the kind of hero that I wanted to have.
Who also is capable of showing enormous mercy.
Right, and he doesn't kill the creature in the end. He subdues it, and then he refuses to kill it. Now, I'm a little bit iffy on that whole thing where he's like, I'm not doing this for your entertainment stuff. I don't know that I drew out of it that the aliens were doing it. So he's presupposing that they're doing it for entertainment, not their stated goal. They say we're doing it to put an end to this.
That is a weird line. That is an odd line. But I accept his idea on not
killing
the Gorn. I mean, because here's the Gorn. It's now completely helpless. It is totally at Kirk's mercy. He's ready to kill it, and he shows compassion. He just says, I can't do this. This isn't right.
Exactly. And then the aliens say, there's hope for you human beings yet, which does fit with that notion that this show is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
About hope. And I hate to be cliche about that, but I mean, that is true. Like I said, that irritates me every time somebody says, well, it's just not the way people would be. Well,
that's not the
that's
point.
The world I, that may be the world I live in, but I don't.
It's not the world
I want it to be in the future.
If I have an opportunity of being able to live into the 23rd century, I'd kind of like it to be maybe what we're being shown on the telly.
Anyway, let's see. What else? We had an episode, Court Martial, that I wanted to talk about.
One of my favorites.
That's an interesting episode. Kirk is accused of negligently killing a crew member. And the computer logs say he did it. And basically, well, then you're guilty.
Yeah.
And we spend the episodes a bit of a legal drama where the lawyer takes the position that Kirk is not getting the right to face his accuser. The accuser is the Enterprise, the accuser is the computer logs, and that is not the intent of trial, being able to face your accuser.
Is I that have a problem with
is
this.
Is that a relevant situation? I mean, if somebody had a videotape of somebody nowadays, if somebody had security camera footage of you breaking into a building and shooting somebody and taking the jewelry and then leaving in your car with your license plate, I would think that's perfectly good evidence.
Pretty open and closed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty shut case. And that's the point that that Kirk's attorney, that's a stand he takes. Sam Coghlan says, you know, computers don't lie. Records don't lie. And here it is. It is Spock who comes forward and says, newsflash, maybe they don't lie, but they can be altered. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that's the one thing about this episode that does bother me. I love the courtroom drama, that aspect. I think that's fantastic. And we get some better character, you know, not a lot of character development, but we do get some. We kind of get a better understanding on Kirk's past. And we get to see more of the Kirk-Spock relationship at work there. But it's Spock who actually solves the case. Coghlan, who's supposed to be this amazing attorney, really becomes irrelevant.
In fact, he's ready to give up.
Yeah, he's prepared to completely give up because he says, well, computers don't lie. And then Spock shows up and says, correction, they do, at least this time.
And, you know, and Kirk is given the option here of
taking a desk assignment
and, you know, this will be forgotten kind of thing. And he refuses because he knows
what he did.
Right. He did the right thing in the right order.
Exactly. He knows it because even after the video playback is shown, he says, but that's not the way it happened. He swears by it.
Mm-hmm.
So that bothers me even more in that Coghlan is not willing to go to bat. He doesn't believe in his client. Completely doesn't believe in him.
Yeah. So that's
So that bothers me. Does that completely negate the story? No. It's still one of my favorites, and I enjoy watching it every time it's on.
A line that I love from that story is, the prosecuting attorney is a beautiful woman who also happens to be
one of Kirk's ex-loves.
And McCoy bumps into her in a bar. He doesn't know that she knows him, and she watches Kirk go out, and she's like watching his butt go out or something. And McCoy, who's trying to hit on her, says, "And if you're wondering, that is indeed Captain Kirk." So he's trying to use
his connection with Kirk to get in with attractive women.
And she goes, I know that, and I'm an old friend of his. And he says, "How come
all his old friends look like you,
and all mine look like doctors?"
Doctors, yeah.
I love that line.
It's a great line.
Enterprise goes back in time, 1969. Tomorrow is yesterday.
One that I enjoyed enormously, although it physics-wise, you know, when it comes to temporal mechanics, there's some questionable things going on towards the end of the episode.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Major questionable.
Time travel episodes in general, where they have
Time travel episodes are always pretty messy.
Then Star Trek holds the theory that says time travel could completely rewrite history and cease to be. That's part of the Star Trek canon.
They visit that idea several times throughout the entire series.
Right. And even up to the point where we mentioned how the whole thing's wiped out of existence for that very reason. We shouldn't let Space Seed go without a mention. Space Seed, the episode that brought us Ricardo Montalban playing an Indian.
Khan Noonien Singh. As far as this episode goes, you know, I think this episode gets far more credit than what it deserves.
Really? I really agree with that. Just like some superhuman from the past get on board, then they want to take over the Enterprise, then we put them down. and dump them off. And the only reason it gets the credit it gets, it's like a forgotten episode, or it would have been a forgotten episode if somebody who didn't like Star Trek hadn't picked it up and made a movie out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an interesting thought here, is that it's picked up by somebody who didn't like Star Trek. And that's the episode they pick. Now, I'm not saying I dislike the episode, but I find the episode wording.
It's uninteresting.
Yeah. Yeah. So best said, less said the better. Although, you know, you can't go too wrong with Ricardo Montalban playing anything. Because he's one of those guys that can just play any ethnicity. I don't know if I've ever seen him play somebody who is Hispanic. But I have seen him play. I was watching Hawaii Five-0 the other day, and he was playing a Japanese. Can you imagine Ricardo Montalban Japanese? It's as unconvincing as Sean Connery, and You Only Live Twice.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. It reminds me of Mark Leonard in Star Trek, who played pretty much every single. He played a character of all the major races except human.
He looked kind of funny.
He played a Vulcan. He even played a Klingon. And if you want to go outside of Star Trek, he played a gorilla once in Planet of the Apes.
Regularly.
Yeah, as General Urko.
In the series, yeah.
But he never played a human. At least not in any science fiction show that I'm aware of.
Fantastic Voyage? No. The other one. It was just like it. With the guys with the kites. The motorized kites.
Well, Otherworld?
Otherworld, yes.
Never saw it. 85.
You're lucky. It made Fantastic Journey look good.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's scary.
Uh-huh. Here's one that I want to bring up that talks about. We talk about science fiction ideas that you can put in play that I think did not work well. And that's A Taste of Armageddon.
I had a feeling you were going to go to that one.
This is an episode where two planets have been at war for centuries. And they've come to the conclusion that war is a messy business. That causes civilizations to break down, economies to be destroyed. Cities and people living in barbarism and tents and caves and eating bears with their bare teeth.
Instead of solving it, they computerize it.
They computerize it, so they're basically playing a game of battleship. And whenever a strike hits, everyone who's in that zone just blindly walks off to a chamber and dies.
Yeah, you make a great point. It's a very, very bad premise. The problem that I have with it, I think you'll agree with me here, is that if war is such a messy business, there's one of two things. You're going to go in one of two directions. A, if war is a very, very messy business, then you're going to want to stop it. You will do what is necessary to achieve a ceasefire and try to find some peace. Or if you hate your enemy so very much that the idea of peace is so utterly repellent to you, then you're not even going to consider the idea of war being messy. You're going to want to continue it anyway.
Yeah, and the interesting solution here at the end of this episode is that Kirk blows up their computers so that they have to go back to fighting a real war. And he says, well, that's what war is about, and you might as well get used to the idea. And so that's an interesting take for where I have previously said Kirk is a moral and upstanding guy.
Now he's turned savage.
That's an interesting solution. You could argue that I just destroyed a computer. I didn't kill anybody. So he's not done anything like that, but he set into motion what could be true bomb attacks. And it's a little more ambiguous to me.
Well, I understand on some level the point that he was trying to make, and that is, and you're right.
You gotta have a reason to want to quit. That's his point.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of ambiguity here. It's very, very fuzzy. But just trying to tell this idea that if war is a bad thing, and if you try to wrap it up into a very, very pretty package, or try to turn it into something that's very clean and sterile, you're not doing yourself any favors as a species. You're not advancing as a society. You're stagnating in some kind of evolutionary process by allowing yourself to trick yourself into thinking that this is some sort of healthy alternative. And Kirk is trying to make the point that war is not good, period. That's simply what he's trying to say. And he's trying to show them the real reality of, you know, this is the reality of war, not what you've been doing. What you've been doing has been playing Battleship with fatal consequences, but it's not war. But you guys say you're at war. Okay, if you say you're at war, then you're at war.
Can you imagine how devoted you have to be to your way of life to march off into the chambers when, you know, somebody sends you a thing and says, "Oh, I was killed today."
You know, and the funny thing is, I need to rewatch this, but I swear, I could just swear that there's a scene where you see some of the population. They're going into one of these disintegration booths, and so help me, I think some of them are smiling.
Could very well be. I think, well, I don't have to put up with this war anymore. So it's a heavy-handed episode, and it's not
as very heavy-handed. And I understand, you know, if you want to go within the story itself, I get why Kirk did it, because according to the computer, the Enterprise was a target. It was a casualty, mm-hmm. and everybody has to report to the disintegration booths. Otherwise, they are in violation of
the treaty.
Yep. Well, if you want to call it a treaty. So I understand Kirk's motivation to want to do this, but the whole message does – I don't agree with it. I don't disagree with it. I find it. I you had the right word. I find the whole thing very ambiguous.
Devil in the Dark.
I think that's a universal favorite. It's one of mine.
It's one of my favorites. I love that episode. I'm
glad you brought this up, because we talked about visual effects earlier. This is one that the digital restoration worked beautifully on, because they were able to take the mining settlement and make it look enormous.
And there's a number of subtle episodes where they have taken what was just a glass shot or a matte shot, and they've put in a background that really does improve the shot. And they've done such a good job on them. And here is a perfect example of it. Although, if you'll notice, in this one, they show that mining complex two or three times, and the guy walking in front of the doorway down at the bottom on the right is the same every time. So that part was a little bit – it's like, wait, that's the same guy. But the fact is that it's right up to modern standards, and the fact that they had really good copy of film and they were able to restore it, the only thing that tells you these are old is the sets, mm-hmm. of the ship. And the fact that the lighting is just not – the cinematography is not normal, modern cinematography. But I like the episode first off because it's just fun.
Oh, absolutely.
And second off because, once again, this is not about man against monster. This is man against
– mother.
The unknown and treating the – you know, yes, the unknown is killing, but – there are two sides to this story, and it's not just savage creature. It is intelligent person and misunderstanding and, you know, the clash of cultures, if you will, between the two things. And once again, Kirk and crew fix it by talking, by trying to understand one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't get that many monster stories, per se.
This episode showed a lot of thought. There's a lot of intelligence in it.
We could not talk about Series 1 of Star Trek without talking about Harlan Ellison's The City on the Edge of Forever, which is...
Any resemblance to Harlan's original story is, I understand, is very, very, very thin. I did read it a long, long, long time ago. And, I mean, so long ago that I don't even remember the details.
I am not... I've not read the original script of it, and I've always liked the episode. It's a, you know, it's a good story. McCoy is ill, goes back in time, destroys the timeline of the Earth, and so Kirk and Spock have to return in an effort to try to restore the timeline. That's the basic premise. But they end up in the Depression. Kirk meets this extraordinary woman. He falls in love with her, and it seems like it's kind of the real thing for Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out she has to die. She is the focal point in time. So it's in that way, it's a typical Harlan Ellison story, because he really does like to put that kind of moral dilemma, life or death, in the hands of another person. And sometimes death is the right answer. We know that. Kirk knows that her death is the right answer.
Yeah, it serves the greater good.
But it's not... I recently watched an episode of Logan's Run that was amazingly written by Ellison, and, you know, kind of the same thing. They had these vials of a cure, and there were six people from the past who could help rebuild the world, and then an earthquake destroys one of the vials, so there's only enough for three of them, and that's in Logan's hands.
Logan has to play God.
Logan has to play God and has to pick who lives and who dies. And, when I was watching that episode, and I thought, that's, for this cruddy show, that was kind of surprising. And then he pops up and goes, oh, it's Harlan Ellison. Okay, fits his pattern. Anyhow, my understanding is this story had a lot of, he wanted to have all sorts of stuff about, like, drug dealing on board the Enterprise.
And that's how McCoy was supposed to completely go bonkers. Because in the series, in the episode as it aired, McCoy accidentally gets himself injected with
hydrocortisone.
And it makes him go completely mental. And he beams down to this planet that has the Guardian of Forever, a gigantic rock edifice time portal. He jumps through it and totally redoes the timeline.
Because he saves her life.
He saves Edith Keeler's life.
And that's another question they don't know when they jump through the portal. It's like, what? Even when they figure out what happened, that it has to be Edith Keeler is the focal point. It's like, what does McCoy do? Did McCoy kill her? Did McCoy save her life?
Right.
And, of course, McCoy returns to normal and becomes the good guy that he is, and he would have saved her.
Yeah. But Kirk stops him.
Kirk has to stop him from saving him. So the timeline is intact, but it's always tops the polls.
It's universally a favorite among Star Trek fans. Now, there was an interesting question that I heard polled. It was posed about this episode. Okay, so the Federation, Starfleet, they now know about this planet with the Guardian of Forever. What's to stop, say, the Klingons or the Romulans from going to this planet and making use of the Guardian? I mean, the Guardian is completely impartial. It does not care.
I would assume that for the most part, the safety is the fact that the Guardian is somewhere deep in Federation territory. I don't know that to be a fact.
We don't know that. All we know is that we don't know where the planet is located. We just know that the Enterprise is dispatched to this area because there are these very strange time quakes that are being that are emanating from the planet.
But usually we see the Klingons in the border, the neutral zone, you know, the disputed territories. That's where we usually see the Klingons. And it's only in Star Trek 2, 3 that the Klingons penetrate deep into the Federation, as far as we can tell.
Now we're left with the school lunch episode.
I never ate school lunches. Operation Annihilate?
Like this.
I liked Operation Annihilate. I thought those creatures were kind of cool, but it's like, and I love that, what is that, Century City or wherever that was shot?
Filmed it is amazing.
That place has been torn down, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a shame. I'd love to go see that for Denova. Yeah.
Yeah, I would have loved. I mean, that's, you know.
It's also in Planet of the. Not Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but.
It's in Conquest.
Conquest. That's it. Yeah, Operation Annihilate. I have a lot to say about that one. I mean, that one is one of the first episodes, though, that used something I really did not like. And that was the Spock has been blinded. Everyone's been blinded, and then, you know, wow, this is really rough. And then at the end, oh, yeah, I have a second eyelid. I forgot about that. How did that in any way cause him to be temporarily blinded? If he's got a second eyelid, then it should have been closed, and he shouldn't have been blinded, and then it should have opened, and he should have been able to see. So that was a really poor... A, it was really poor writing.
And, yeah, it's
and
cheap.
B, it's the first of the, oh, by the way, Vulcans have super powers.
Vulcans are superior.
Yeah.
By the way, we're out talking about the location. It was the shooting location for Denver Colony was One Space Park in Redondo Beach. The beam down point was outside the cafeteria at the TRW Space and Defense, which merged with Northrop Grumman in 2002. And it's also where the Apollo program, the Lunar Module Descent Engine, as well as other spacecraft were developed.
So it was like really in outer space.
It's
for real.
Such a futuristic looking city. And it was the perfect location to film that. I just thought that the location is what sells it for me.
It's really one of the few times we got to see an Earth colony, too, that wasn't like very primitive or, you know, like
it's
rustic.
The episode that also introduces us to Kirk's brother.
Briefly.
Very briefly.
Very briefly, because he's
also
dead when they get
William
there.
Shatner with a mustache.
I kind of bummed about that, frankly. I really feel bad about them killing his brother, even though he's like dead before they even get there.
They
just
killed the
like...
brother and they killed the sister-in-law.
Yep, and the only one left was the boy.
The gay nephew.
Did not know that he was a gay nephew.
Yeah, they actually, in the Star Trek Phase 2 scripts, yes, we find out that Peter was gay.
Sometimes I'm glad they didn't make Phase 2.
Well, they're making it now. They're making it for the web.
Well, not officially. It's some...
They're actually using scripts that were written.
I've seen some of those, and there's a reason why they didn't make those. Well, we've got other episodes of Star Trek in the first series. We're not going to talk about them because we couldn't possibly do that. We've already been rambling on for a little bit longer.
If we didn't talk about them here, it's because they were not worth talking about.
It could be that. I mean, I could see there are some things to talk about in Mud's Women or the Galileo 7. I love the Galileo 7.
Okay, I'll say this about Mud's Women. Hated it. Move on.
I didn't really care for – I don't like Harry Mudd. So you put him in an episode, and I disliked it. So that was fine.
I like Harry Mudd. I just don't like him in that particular episode. He's really just awful.
And let's see what else we –
Galileo 7 I did like.
I love the Galileo 7.
I like that one, although –
because it's got Bigfoot in it.
Yeah, it's got Bigfoot, although the – was it Commissioner Fox? Oh my God, what a jerk he is!
And the restoration on Galileo 7.
Oh, the restoration is beautiful.
Finally makes sense. You know, when they fire the flare and the shuttlecraft shoots off and it's actually producing a flare across the face of the planet. That
looked great.
You look at that and you go, now the show makes sense. Before it was kind of like,
the Murasaki quasar looks just beautiful. Yeah. Looks like something Hubble may have taken a photo of.
And I suppose we should just briefly mention the Menagerie Part 1 and 2, Star Trek's only two-part episode, in which, in a what I assume was a budget-saving technique, they re-encapsulated the original Jeffrey Hunter Star Trek pilot.
Yeah.
And encapsulated it within the confines of a framing story so that they were able to tell it in a slightly different form, because I don't think the complete flavor of the story comes through, but it comes close.
No, it doesn't. It comes close because I remember when I saw The Cage for the first time, I actually bought a videotape. And, you know, this is back in the VCR days. Bought a videotape of The Cage. And I remember the first time I watched it in its entirety, I thought, wow, it's really a shame they could not have shown this. At least used all of this in the Menagerie, because I thought it was just fantastic.
Yeah, and of course the difference is that in the ending, in the Menagerie, in the Kirk version, they have taken the crippled Captain Pike back to this planet of illusion, and we see him walking away with the beautiful
girl. With young Vina.
Walking away, and you go, wow, they've given him the illusion, even though it's impossible for him to move or talk, they've given him the illusion that he's walking up these steps. Even though he's in a wheelchair. So I'm unclear on that one. But in the original, of course, Kirk and them leave. Or
Pike.
Kirk, Pike and them, sorry. Leave, and he has compassion for the woman. Because she's really hideously deformed, but they've been convincing her through their illusion that she's beautiful. And they said, well, will you give her back her illusion of beauty? And even more. And she has the illusion of Pike going with her. And that's an interesting
And the ending scene made a lot more sense in the original form.
And it was nicer. The aliens at the end, even though they were the bad guys, once again came off as they actually did kind of care. Because they gave her what she wanted
to make her happy. But you get that in Menagerie too. I mean, the whole reason Spock is taking Pike there is because Pike crippled in a really bad accident and the Talosians had pity.
Yeah.
They knew they were a dying race. They had met Pike and they thought, you know, we've got this crippled Vina. Here's a crippled Pike. Let's do something for them.
But in their version, crippled Vina spent 15 more years by herself until they brought Pike back. And in the actual version, she didn't realize he left.
Yeah.
she thought he stayed with him.
We really don't know.
I'm guessing that she thinks he stayed. I would guess that it would be based on what she had gone through with Pike, that she would have, if she had known for sure that it was just an illusion, then that probably would have been unsatisfactory.
I don't know. She was willing to surrender herself to the whole idea of illusion at that point. As she said, they owned her.
But Pike was getting her to come back. That was the point. He was bringing back the fight in her.
She wouldn't do it.
So I don't think he would be the representative of her trying to get her humanity back, and then to know that that was just an illusion would be, I think they had to make her not know. But I kind of get the feeling
that she must have known, unless they blanked out her memory, because here's Pike who's going through all these efforts, all these attempts at trying to escape. Everything about what he needs to do is to get off that planet and to go back to the ship. That's his primary goal. She knows that. She's at his side the entire time he's pushing it. And all of a sudden, now he's going to stay? No. I'm sure that she knew that he was – that this Pike that was going back with her, I'm sure that she knew that was an illusion, but she didn't care. Much along the same way that she didn't care that she's not really young. She's not really beautiful. She's old and she's crippled. She knows that, but she doesn't care because she feels that she's not.
Well, listeners, you can write in and give us your opinion on that one. In any case, next time on episode 98, we will be entering the land of the people with the really bad Russian accents.
The arrival
of Mr. Chekhov and some minor changes for Star Trek, I'd say. A little bit more emphasis on the Spock character. There we go. Anyway, we hope you'll join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Cheers.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Username, Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.